I'd like to get started. I'm not sure, but I may have a laptop projector compatibility with the center. I didn't talk to the IT people, but it seems to work for the PC now. So this particular tablet I'm using comes from about 2004, so I guess it had to happen. So I'll try to get that straightened out so we can use the big projector screen. In the meantime, I'm stuck again today, so my apologies, especially over here in the trouble scene. I have a few hard copies of the syllabus up front after class if you are lacking that. If you're not connected with your registration in Blackboard, then you want to do so, because I can send emails out to class with that. Blackboard was not available until this morning because I wasn't using it and I didn't realize it. Somebody emailed me, so it's now available, so you should be able to see it, of course, when we do start using it. I have posted on the class website, which is the one I control over in the physics server, so it's a little simpler. It's like it's pretty clunky, so I have an easier time using one over physics. I posted problem set one, lecture one slides, and audio. And just so you know, that will happen for every lecture, depending on what's going on in my life. It may happen fast, it may happen a few days later. So those will show up typically. I got a few emails over the weekend with little technical issues, like the homework problems aren't in my book, or I can't download this. It's helpful. I'm happy to try to help. If you do ask me to think about something, if you're registering a technical issue, tell me a little bit about it. Because if all I get is this, you know, this doesn't work, I can't do much about it. I don't even know what you're looking at. So if it's a computer thing, tell me what your operating system is. You know, if you know it's a PDF file, let me know that you can typically read PDF files. It looks like a broken link. I mean, so give me a little information and then I'll try to help you. A reminder that, we have regular class on Thursday, but this Friday we have a one-time only unusual lecture, which has to do mainly with statistics. And it's hard to imagine a worse thing to have to do with a late Friday afternoon than to sit through a statistics lecture. However, I hope that it will be in a form that you probably haven't seen before, and I can give you a good feeling for statistics and some of the things that you'll need for lab, maybe with some flavor that you haven't seen before, because I think often it's presented in such a way that it isn't very approachable. So I'll try to do well on that on Friday for you. Just a reminder, there are no workshops this week. They'll start next Monday. I wanted to actually get some material under our belt first. Okay? So last time, we did talk a bit about the organization of the course, and I guess I would like to give you the opportunity to ask questions if you got a chance to read the syllabus or thought about something and now have a concern. Yes? I don't think so. I don't know. I don't run the lab. I'll try to find out when it is and email everybody. I think not.
How long is the lecture on Friday?
It'll probably run about an hour and a half. Starts at 3:30.
Will
the estimating thing be tested?
My daughter's homework number 9 was
yeah. Right. Okay, so it appears that at least one of you is bothered by the homework problem of estimating number of heartbeats in a lifetime. Actually, part of what I'm trying to do with that particular problem is to exactly bother you about that kind of thing, right? How many heartbeats, estimate the human heartbeats in a lifetime? Well, who knows how long we live, it varies in a minute. So that's what the whole idea of estimating is all about, to get a sense of whether this makes sense. it is fair game, I think, for a test to sort of ask you guys to estimate something. The real reason why we're talking about it is because I'd like you to get a sense of when and how. I mean, I'd rather you be able to think your way through whether any answers you come up with make sense or not. And sometimes the best way to do that is a back of the envelope sort of estimate sort of thing. So that's really where it folds in. But it would be fair game for a test, but it's also impossible to really study for it. So I wouldn't worry about it. If it shows up, then you do your best there. But literally, sometimes you just have to... You know a range that human heartbeats might have. And even if you have to sit and time your own, which might be fast, on exam, but you know, that's okay. So the whole idea with these estimates is to sort of get things within a factor of 10 so that the final answer is, you know, something in the ballpark. That's the idea. And it's a very powerful thing, and actually a lot of people really aren't comfortable with it, especially in the world of Google. You know, we're used to getting that instantaneous authoritative answer, and makes it useful to be able to deal with uncertainty. There's a hand up over here.
If we can't make it on Friday, will you be posting that lecture too?
It will be posted, and I will try to also post the audio. Anything else? Okay. So last time, once we talked about the course, we talked a little bit about human perspective, scales in our universe that we have to deal with, and the fact that the human perspective really encompasses only a small range of the available scales. So there's a natural bias that you might expect to come from the human point of view, which, interestingly, can sometimes work for us. Very often in the history of physics, probably in the history of science, but certainly in the history of physics, certain concepts that come about, if the human thinks they're beautiful, if they make sort of sense, very often they actually turn out to be found in nature. And there are numerous examples of beautiful theories that are mathematically pretty if you look at them, or really elegant, and physicists sort of think, oh, this is really great. And then it turns out experimental evidence is found. So there are theorists who will justify some of the things they work on by the fact that it's beautiful and elegant. So general relativity that Einstein came up with in about 1914, 17, is one of those things. When it first came out, physicists all believed that there's not a shred of scientific evidence to support it for some number of years. So sometimes the human bias can actually work for you. Sometimes it really works against you. So in particular, what I really wanted to warn you about is that even in the world of normal everyday scales and everything that you would deal with, your intuition might mislead you. So we're going to develop a formalism that we're going to use in class to how to analyze problems. And you need to learn to go with the formalism, even if you think you know what's going on initially. Because your thinking sometimes is going to be right, but it's sometimes just going to be wrong. And the formalism is sort of designed to catch that. After the fact, if it's not what you were expecting, then usually you can look at it and sort of figure out what you're thinking, how your thinking was wrong. And then you have a lot of confidence in what you're doing. So that was really the point of what I was trying to say. So, any thoughts about last time? Alright, so, let's start out today with new material. What is time? When's the last time we thought about that? Is it still too early in the day to worry about that? What do you think?
The process of moving through
three-dimensional space. What do you think?
Measuring the duration of an event.
Measuring the duration of an event?
Method of subdividing the length of the Earth's rotation around the sun.
A method of subdividing the length of the Earth's rotation around the sun. That's what we all think about, aren't we? No? Okay, certainly a technique for measuring. How do you... How do you know you need time? The whole concept. What would your life be like if you had no time? And I don't mean no time to do things, but the time didn't exist. If you think my lectures are boring, imagine how boring they would be if time didn't exist. How would you know? Suddenly we enter a Harry Potter universe and I can stop time. How would you know? You wouldn't know because everything would just stop. But that's the point. Change demands time. The only way you know you have change is by looking at how things change as a function of time. If you stop time, you sort of live in this boring, nothing can move, nothing can seem, nothing can think, right? There is no change. Your molecules don't move, your atoms don't. Okay? So life is enormously boring. So we know that we have to have time because we live in a universe of change. And the concept of time, which you have, it is intertwined, I think, with your concept of space, but we really think of three immutable dimensions of space moving at a fixed rate, so a constant speed, through time in one direction. Right? Now you might perceive time to be very different, right? In about a half an hour, it may seem to drag on and on and on, and when you were playing over the weekend, it might seem to go very fast when you're at a party or something. So your biological perception is definitely odd. But if you were to use a watch, right, it's designed to give you a constant rate. And so this is our vision of time. And in fact, the vast majority, perhaps everything that we do this semester, with the exception of if I play a little bit with special relativity, that is the concept that will serve you. It's basically the Newtonian concept of space and time, and you should hold on to it because it will serve you very well. It turns out to be wrong, but you don't have to worry about that for all that we're going to do this semester. That's something that happens. You begin to perceive problems with our concept of space and time when you look at things that are very massive or very fast or very large, and it's one of the places where human intuition completely falls apart because we very strongly believe in this immutable space moving through time and think of time also as sort of this abstract concept that's immutable. And it turns out that those things are not true, and it's one of those examples where the world is much stranger than you could ever believe. But having said that, the reason I'm bringing all this up is that time is one of the important components if you want to make observations of nature, which is really where we come in. Because as a scientist, your job is really to look at nature and make observations. And so what kinds of things can you observe? Growth and decay, absolutely.
Change.
You can observe change, yes, in all sorts of things.
Movement, size, mass.
Movement, size, mass, okay. We're a physics class, so that's what we have to do. Most of the stuff we deal with is very dead. Well, anyway, so yeah, we can measure a lot of things. So what I want to do is really start by looking at sort of the simplest set of things that we can measure and really look at basic motion of objects. Okay, that's at the core of what we do in physics and really science as a whole. So the first thing that we want to get into is a study of one-dimensional motion. But that, of course, sounds too blasé. If you say that, no one's going to be impressed. Your grandma won't be impressed, and people will know what you're talking about. So if you haven't learned this already, given you're juniors, you may already know this. Part of what we have to teach you to do as scientists is to obfuscate what it is that you normally are thinking about so that we can keep the masses at bay and job security. So we have to layer everything in lots of language that makes simple concepts seem very complicated, okay? So as you develop as scientists and you mature, you'll understand that this is a very important aspect of what it is that we do, and you need to learn to make very simple things as complicated as possible. So we no longer talk about one-dimensional motion. What we'll do is we'll call this one-dimensional kinematics. See, isn't that better? Nobody knows what we're talking about now. Alright, so one-dimensional kinematics. And when we talk about one-dimensional kinematics, we'll talk about the kinematic variables. So if you want to think about motion, certainly two things that are very fundamental that you can imagine that we have to think about would be position and time. So there are actually four variables, and we'll get to the others soon. But two of them are position and time. Typically, we'll use a symbol for time, small t, and we will typically use seconds, although you may be using, depending on the problem. I mean, it may be that the time will be counted in years or something like that. Position, in a one-dimensional problem, it is conventional to use a variable which is just x. And I think we're sort of conditioned to think of x as a horizontal location. But in a one-dimensional problem, we may be thinking about something that does this. It's a one-dimensional problem, so you have to be a little careful about what you mean when you talk about vertical and horizontal. But you can imagine having a one-dimensional problem in the vertical plane or the horizontal plane, and you're only considering the motion like that. There's nothing special about x belonging to the horizontal, and this is part of the thing we're going to be going through in the next 10 days, is that you have to define your coordinate system and your directions and what's positive and what's negative and how the axes are. And that may very well change from problem to problem. So you have to really pay attention to what you're doing. You have to make choices and make definitions within doing these problems. And then you have to stick with that definition throughout the problem, otherwise you run into trouble. So it's inconsistencies that can be the real problem. Okay, so we're talking one-dimensional motion, kinematics. So imagine that we consider motion along the floor here, okay? So you can imagine having a scale, like a piece of graph paper, set along here. And I'll talk a bit more about units. We have to choose units, right? Because I could measure segments of this length in all sorts of different units. We could work in furlongs, right? We could do inches, we could do meters, we could do centimeters. So in this class, we will typically use metric system units, MKS units, meters, kilograms, seconds. You're probably pretty used to that from chemistry, I certainly hope so. One reason to do that, again, is to keep the evil masses at bay, so you have job security, because they work in football fields and yards and things here. The other reason is that the metric system is phenomenally wonderful to use because of your ability to convert things using powers of 10. So it's a beautiful, beautiful system. So we will generally use the metric system. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time beating you up over learning how to convert from metric system units to English units. But if any of you have any contact with the engineering world as you do whatever it is you do, keep in mind that they often, in the U.S., will often work in English units because the industry is often tooled in English units here. So they need to be versed in both, but you can run into real troubles when you have miscommunication between the two. Getting ahead of myself. Sorry. The funniest example of this was when NASA missed Mars with a space probe because the engineers had worked in a unit of rocket thrust called foot pounds, which is the English unit. Okay, that's what you would use if you were talking football fields and, you know, 100-yard football fields type of thing. And the people who were calculating how long to turn the rocket on in order to have the correct orbit thought that they had worked in the unit of force, which was the metric system unit called Newtons. And so when the engineers who designed the rocket and the orbit people who were calculating how long to turn the thing on and off were using the wrong units, they crashed the orbiter or missed Mars altogether, I forget which. So it's I'm very serious when I say you really have to watch your units in the real world when you're dealing with whatever it is you're doing, okay? Alright, so I need 3 volunteers. Come on down. Come on over. One more. What we do when we study motion is we make graphs. So I'm going to plot position versus time. And you are?
Isaiah.
Sarah.
John.
Okay, Isaiah, Sarah, and John. And so what I want to do is to actually look at motion. So what I want to do is, Isaiah, if you would come over here, start right here, and just walk at a constant rate, not too fast. And I want you to think about sort of, if he's walking at a constant rate, what's happening between here and here. Okay, thank you, Isaiah. So he's moving at a constant speed. That was fun, wasn't it? So he has a position that's associated with a time here, and a position that's associated with a time here. Okay? And so what I'd like to do is to sort of correlate those, a position and a time, and I'm going to define, because I have the power of doing this, okay? I'm going to define the zero of the x-coordinate, the zero of the position, right here, to be at the moment he was here, okay? And I'm going to define, because I can do that, the positive direction to be that way. Okay? And so if I now think about what his motion was, he started at zero, right here, and as he went from through that point to this point, it was some positive x at some positive t later. So might be something like that. Okay? And if he was moving sort of at a constant rate, then you might expect basically his motion would look like something like that. Okay? So he moves from that point to this point, so he moves a certain distance x, sort of delta x, Delta, usually, that's what I mean by difference. I'll use that Greek symbol. Okay? And he moves in a certain time like this, a delta T. Okay? Isaiah, tell me how to spell your name.
That's right. No, that was right.
Oh, but I have to go. Isaiah. Oh.
Hey. Yeah. Boom.
What?
That's good.
Hey,
hey. That was good. No, you had it right.
You're trying to get it.
No, there's an I. There's an I.
Like that?
Yep.
All right, that's the same. Okay, Sarah. I would like you to do the same thing as Isaiah did, but I want you to go, you know, twice as fast. All right. Okay, so now relative to what I have for Isaiah, what's it going to look like?
Steep. Twice as steep.
She goes the same delta x. Okay, so this distance is the same, but it's in about half the time. Okay, so the same delta x, so she comes up to here, but in about half the time, so she'd be about there. So hers would look something like that. Okay. Okay. Magic happens. Okay, so, John. This is getting pretty lame now because I've already made my point. But you can go and go, you know, about half as fast as Isaiah. All right, so John would look something like this because he goes the same distance x here, but now in a time that's about twice as large. So one of the things you'll notice is that there's a correlation between... Thank you all. Okay, so... There's a correlation between the speed and sort of the shape of this curve, right? So you can think about that. Now suppose that Sarah, instead of doing this, okay, was doing this. What's it going to look like?
Of a negative slope.
Right. Sarah would be going forward in time, because time's continuing on, okay? But she would be going backwards from some positive but non-zero x, okay, back to zero. So it would look something like... that, I think. So we have a different slope because she's going backwards. So, anyway, you have to think your way through the different types of motion. So, let us suppose that let's do it a little bit different. Let us say that let me start here at the 0x, okay? And I'm going to walk at a constant speed that way, and then I'm going to come right back, okay? And I want to set the 0 of time where I turn around, or where I stop my motion trigger. Okay, so constant speed, back, constant speed, back. What would that look like? Okay, so what we said was I turned around at some positive x, okay? So I'll be up here at t equals zero. So I started back before t equals zero, because I defined t equals zero where I turned around, and I did something like this. Okay, so there's a correlation between this plot and what it gets. So what's happening is I start at negative time. Does that bother you? Negative time. And that's a little bit weird, but just fine with this. We can define the zero time whenever we want, okay? But once you've done it, you have to stick with that for that example or that problem or whatever, okay? So I'm going to start because I have this arbitrary power to do so. I can't make the projector work, but I can set the zero time. So I will start at a negative time, and then I will move a certain distance, okay, in a certain time that defines the slope. The slope is steady because, in principle, I'm walking at the same speed, so the same delta x, delta t slope. And then I turned around, so now I go backwards in x. I go negative bit in x for a given t, so the slope turns over. So we can analyze the motion. I mean, if you want to get down to it, we have to. You can analyze the motion by looking very carefully at the position and the time graph. So let's look at a particular example now. But what I want to look at is something a little different. Let's suppose that you're starting off, but you're accelerating. So you're like a drag racer or something. So let's assume somebody starts on a drag racer, and they start at zero speed, right? And then they just accelerate. They keep going faster and faster and faster as a function of time. So to think about what the graph would look like, let's say that we start with them at x equals 0, at t equals 0. So in fact, I don't really need to be carrying all this stuff, because I'm only going to work in the positive side. In fact, I'm going to just kill that and start over. Okay, so initially they're starting from zero speed. So they go in a time interval, let's think of it as a second, they go a small distance. Right? If you follow their motion a little bit further along, because they're going faster, in the same time interval, they'll now cover more x. Okay? And then a little further in their motion, because they're going even faster in that same time interval, they will go even more of a distance. Okay? So what's going to happen with this motion is that you can imagine initially they go a small x in a certain amount of time. So let's say they go a little x in this amount of time. So they look something like that. Later in the motion, they will go a bigger x in the same amount of time. So instead, later on, at some later time, they might go a bigger distance in the same amount of time, right? And then later on, they might be going even a bigger distance in the same amount of time. So, if I draw it, this wasn't very well done, sorry. It's probably better to shoot, do the whole curve. And then analyze it. So what's happening is they cover more and more x as you go further in time. So the curve would look something like this. Right, so here they go a smallish x for a certain amount of time. Over here they go a much bigger x for the same amount of time. And here they go a much, much bigger x for the same amount of time. Right? So this would be an example of accelerating motion. Something like a drag racer. So what I'd like to do is to sort of look at this, and then at any given time, what's happening is their speed is changing. They start out very slow, right, and then they're going faster and faster and faster as they go. So we can define something which we will call their average steam. Over a time interval, I'm going to call this one T sub I because I'm just choosing some arbitrary time. But I want to say that it's a single interval, so I'll call this one T sub I plus 1. So you can think of this as, you know, 10 seconds into the motion, we'll define that as T sub I, and then 11 seconds into the motion would be T sub I plus 1 or whatever. And there will be a position associated with that T sub I, which is the position it was at that moment, and we'll call it X sub I, and there will be an X sub I plus 1, okay? And if we look at the motion over just that time interval, we can ask how fast were they going, okay? And speed is a measure of distance that you go in time. Actually, though, I want to be a little bit more specific. I want to say displacement. Over time. So we're going to define the speed of the race car, the average speed, to be X sub I plus 1 minus X sub I over T sub I plus 1 minus T sub I. So it's really just, which we'll usually write as a delta X over a delta T. Delta literally means a finite difference between two numbers that you see, okay? And this is what we call average speed. If you go a big distance in a certain time, you have a large speed, right? You're going very fast. Okay? There is nothing in this that specifies whether the drag racer is going that way or that way. Okay? Absolute values there, just because that's what I want there to be no difference. Speed is a measure of how fast you go. It has nothing to do with what direction you're going. If you add the direction in and you specify the direction, we no longer call it speed. It's then called velocity. So average velocity is exactly the same thing as average speed, but it includes the direction. In English, we sort of use those words interchangeably, but in physics, they're very different. Very specific meaning to what speed is and what velocity is, okay? Even in a one-dimensional problem. So, if we've defined positive to be this direction, okay, we know that we have a positive velocity if the car is going this way because delta x, that is x at I plus 1, so x a little further in time, is over here, is a bigger x than x at t. So that difference is positive. The ti plus 1 minus t sub I is always going to be positive. So you'll have a positive number if the drag racer is moving that way. Okay? If the drag racer is moving this way, then at t sub I they are here, and at t sub I plus 1 they are there. X at I plus 1 is now a smaller number than x at I. So xi plus 1 minus x sub I is going to be a negative. Okay? So mathematically, the way we say this way or that way is with the velocity, it's positive if it's this way, and it is negative if it's that way. Okay? So in a one-dimensional problem, you determine direction by the algebraic sign. And you can do that because the algebraic sign is positive or negative. Okay? So that's all you need mathematically, is something that says it's this way or that way. Okay, it's very simple. Am I boring the crap out of you? I sincerely hope so. Because it was boring me. We're going to do some one-dimensional motion, and the reason that you want to bear with me is because when we do much more complex motion, the way that you do many-dimensional motion is you break it down into, if it's three-dimensional motion, for example, you break it down into three different sets of one-dimensional motion that all get added together. All right? So complex motion always breaks down into this in the end. Okay, so we're going to learn how to deal with, you know, very complicated motion in three dimensions, but in the end, you will deconvolute, like, that's like a math word or a physics word. Does that make sense to you? Is that an English word too? Sometimes, okay, so we'll deconvolute this multidimensional thing into three one-dimensional problems. And those you can usually analyze and make a lot more sense. So that's why we're sort of stuck doing this. So average speed is position over time. Average velocity is distance over time. So in terms of units, what we want is a distance over a time. And in the MK, in the metric system or the MKS system, M stands for meters, K stands for kilograms, and S stands for seconds. So there's a self-consistent set of units that we'll use typically, and that's called the MKS system. So in those units, then, we'll measure speed and velocity in meters per second. And how you can tell the difference between whether it's in speed or velocity is not whether its unit is meters per second or not, it is whether the direction is specified. So I will tell you I'm going 50 meters per second north or 50 meters per second south. Those are the same speed, but they're different velocities. Okay? In physics speak, and I guess this is also true in English, velocity is made up of a magnitude, so a number, times a direction. And the magnitude of the velocity, that is the size of it, is really what we mean by speed. Are you okay with that? So let's go back to our drag racer, and let's look at the
time.
The position versus time on here. And if we want to look at the average speed over a certain interval, then we can look over a certain time, let's call this delta t. And during that time, the drag racer goes a certain delta x. So the speed is equal to delta x over delta t. That's the average speed. But note that in the average, we're ignoring everything that happens in the middle. It doesn't matter what this drag racer did in the middle of its motion. Okay? It could actually have done something really strange. It might have had the normal motion all the way up to this point, and then the driver did something really weird. I guess you can't go backwards there. That's the problem. So maybe the driver slowed down and then sped way up, but ended up at that same position, you know, that bit of time later. You could never distinguish the motion of those two things. Because if all you're doing is taking the position and time at that point, the position and time at that point, that's all you need for the average speed. Okay? Anything could happen in here, in principle. I want to sort of blow that up. I'm gonna sort of exaggerate what we were just talking about. So let me start with something that looks like this. And let's look at the average speed over this interval. Okay. The average speed is basically the slope between those two points, right? It's the rise over the run. So that's how far up you go over how far you go here. So it's basically the slope of this line. That would represent the delta x over delta t, which is the average speed. But I want you to notice how unrepresentative that is of what is going on throughout this little interval. Okay? Here's the average speed. But at the start of the interval, this car, because it's going faster and faster, is actually going a good bit slower. So if I were to look at the average speed over a small interval here, it would actually be lower, right? It would correspond to the John's walking here when he walked more slowly. And if you go to the end of the interval, okay, now because the car is going faster and faster, throughout that interval it is speeding up. So at the end of the interval here, it's going much faster than the average, okay? So, it's interesting to ask, if you really want to understand the motion, when you look at it over a large interval, clearly it's not You get it. You get an imperfect picture. Okay? So, if you wanted to have a better picture of the motion throughout that interval, then you might look at a smaller time interval. Right? And if you look at a smaller time interval, then you may see some, because the motion is evolving, it may be different through that time interval, but the difference is going to be a little bit less. I didn't say that well. Because the motion is evolving, if you really want to understand the motion, we need to look at it over a smaller and smaller time interval. Because if you look over a large time interval, since the motion is evolving, it's going to be changing through that time interval, so it doesn't do you much good. So, Isaac Newton understood this. And in order to deal with it, he invented calculus. Imagine that. He's looking at some problem, go, I don't know how to solve that. I'll invent a whole new area of mathematics to deal with it. Okay, so that's really what he did. So you can imagine if we have this time interval where things are changing so dramatically in here. And let us suppose that we start out with a certain delta t here. And I want to look at the average speed, delta x over delta t. But instead of looking at it over this entire interval, what I'd like to do is to look at it over successively smaller delta t's. And note that as I look at it over successively smaller delta t's, the average speed becomes asymptotically close to the speed at this very instant of time, at the very start here. So, if we shrink t down, so if we look at it in the limit of delta t goes to zero, then this difference in the finite difference ratio becomes the differential ratio, which is known as the derivative. So you okay with that? Does that make sense? If I tell you, I want to know what is the speed right at this point, one way to do it is to look at the average speed, okay? But the average speed requires that I have a finite delta t and a finite delta x because I have to be able to measure them, all right? And if I have a finite delta t, because the speed is evolving, the measure that I get for the average will clearly not be exactly the speed at that very point. And the only way to get the speed at that very point is to have that time interval go smaller and smaller and smaller. And in the limit that time interval is zero, you have what's known as the derivative, or the slope right at that point. Okay? And that is known as the instantaneous speed. I don't know if they teach you this. I'm going to try to give you a feeling for calculus in a way that usually you won't see it in the calc class. But a way to think about this is the differential x and the differential t. I want you to think of the differential x as a really teeny tiny x. You can think of it as an interval, but it is really small. So small you can't get it any smaller. So, and delta t would be over such a short time that you can't think of it. So there's some reality to the dx and the dt. And we use a symbol that's different. If I say delta x, I mean something sort of finite. That is, something can change within that interval. Okay? Or delta t, you can have a change. But if I talk about a dt, dt happens so fast, even if something is changing, effectively it hasn't changed in that little dt. Okay? So that's sort of the difference. So this is defined as the instantaneous speed. And if I add direction, then that becomes the instantaneous velocity. You okay with that? Now you've done, most of you have done plenty of calculus to know that the derivative of a graph at a given point is also the slope. So I hope that it makes sense to you that if something is going very slow, it will have a low slope because it goes a small distance x over a large distance t. If it's going very fast, it has a large delta x over a small t, so its slope is going to be much steeper. Okay? If something has zero slope, it has no change in x as a function of time. So it's just sitting still. Okay? Zero slope corresponds to zero speed. Okay? All right. I haven't yet technically figured out this year's incarnation of the clickers, but this is, we're going to do sort of a clicker problem without the clickers right here. So what I would like you to do is to look at this particular problem. So given this motion, okay, and that motion actually corresponds roughly to the motion in one dimension of this. Okay? You start out at 0x, by defining to be where my hand is, and then x becomes very positive and then it comes back down to 0. Okay? That's the forward motion of the projectile. So given this, what I would like you to do is to think for a moment as to whether you believe if I were to plot the vt graph, that is the velocity graph, v versus t for the same object, look at each of these and decide in your mind which one you think is the most appropriate description. Have that in your mind? Which one do you think it is? Okay. Now what I'd like you to do is to fix the number of the one that you think is the most appropriate in your mind, and then I want you to close your eyes, and when I say the number, I want you to raise your hand. That way I can give you some insight as to how many of you thought different things. It's not, I'm not trying to find out who's right or wrong. I'm just trying to get some general gist of who's getting it, who's not. Okay, so close your eyes so you don't see when everybody else raises their hand. And all of you who thought it was number one. Hold on, I need to write something down. Okay, so number two. Number three. Number four. Number five. Okay, you can open your eyes now. So I just wrote in numbers roughly what I just could sort of look at. Now I didn't really care for counting. So for number one, about 20 of you. Number two, I saw a couple of hands go up. Number three, by far and away the winner, there were about 50 of you. Number four, seven. Number five, six. Okay. If you said number three, would you defend that for me? Somebody, why do you think number three? What do you think?
On the next one, see, it's increasing to your positive value for your derivative, meaning that your first quadrant should have a negative slope.
Okay, so he's saying at the start, you have a positive and large slope, and then which would start you here, okay?
And then when it gets to maximum, it drops back down to the negative slope.
Okay, so when you get to the maximum, after that, you now have a negative slope, which means you have to have a negative velocity. So that fact means that you have to be here or here. Okay? Both of them start positive and large and end at zero. Why not this one? What do you think?
That's constant. That's it.
Why do you say it's constant?
Well, when you take the derivative, thanks.
I think with a lot of criteria, this one and these two are the better answers, right? Because you start positive, you know you have a positive slope here, you know you have to have a negative slope here because you have a negative velocity over here. So these two are both consistent with that. You also have a point where the velocity in x, that is, you have no motion in x at the height, at the top of its motion, right? Because it's turning around, it gets up here, and for that very instant, it has a speed of zero, or velocity of zero, the derivative is zero. So that would be this moment. So you have a zero slope right here, and you pass through zero here and here. So both of those, are consistent. The statement was, well, the rate of change of that slope is constant, okay? And I really haven't given you information to let you judge that. I would say I would rule this one out because this has a large V here, but the slope is... changing pretty dramatically. I don't know, maybe where we are right now, I would actually call these both fairly equivalent. The intuition I want you to have, and we're not there yet, but I think you can use it a little bit ahead of time, is that if you're in a situation where the force in the problem is constant, which in this case is just the force of Earth on the object, if that's constant, then the rate of change of the velocity is constant, okay? Which we will say, once I introduce it, we'll say the acceleration is constant. So that's actually, in about a week and a half, how you know the answer is the why this is the correct one and that one's not, okay? But I think for today, they're both roughly equivalent. Okay, so that sort of gets us to the next step, which is if we look at this graph like this VT graph, we can play the same kind of game that we just played with the XT graph, which is we can look at it over intervals of time. And we can look to see what is the change in the velocity over those intervals of time. So we can define something which is this ratio very similar to what we did with x. So the change in the velocity over change in time as the average velocity. And by velocity now we have direction included. Okay. Similarly, you'll note that if we look at some VT graph, the velocity at this point, that is the slope, And the, oh, I'm sorry, this is now a detail for that. You can see that the rate of change of the velocity here . But what I wanted to say, I actually ended up drawing exactly the wrong graph, sorry, because I was about to make... Never mind. Let me draw something different. Okay. Sorry for that messed up your notes. I was about to talk about how So we can calculate the average velocity over this interval. Well, you guys are more asleep than I am. We delta x over delta t is average velocity. What we want to look at here is the change in the velocity with respect to time. That's not velocity, right? That's what we define as the rate of change of the velocity is the average acceleration. So we can look at how the velocity is here and the velocity is at that point, okay? And we can define over a time interval how the velocity has changed, which is what we call acceleration, the rate of change of the velocity. Okay? Similarly to what we did earlier, if we go to the limit of small time interval, we get what's known as the instantaneous velocity. Instantaneous acceleration. I made myself in, sorry. So in the same way the velocity is the slope of the xt graph, the acceleration is the slope of the VT graph. Okay, and I think it's a little bit intuitively a little harder to sort of picture acceleration, but in terms of units, let's look at this. We have a change in velocity. Velocity is measured in meters per second because it's a change in distance over change in time. We want to divide that by change in time. So the units for acceleration will be a distance over a time squared. Or typically in MKS units, this will be meters per second squared. I think I made a file to use today, which I did not actually bring with me. I have something from last time I taught this class, way back when, which I modified, so sorry for that, but we'll have to deal with what I have. So let's suppose that we had a rocket launch, okay? And this is the XT plot. How did that plot go?
Constant velocity.
probably not. This is the XT graph. Velocity would be the slope of this, so the velocity change. Would you want to be on the tropics? Because you start out on the ground, and several seconds later, you're back on the ground. You're probably not sweating it too much at that point, okay? So definitely not a good rocket flight. Here's the velocity. You're in a rocket, so you're going faster and faster, okay? Going up. And then, your engine shuts off, basically. So now you start to go slower and slower. The slope may be different because the engine is pushing up with a certain force, and then it turns off, and now gravity is pulling down. Those two forces are different, right? They're not. If they weren't different, then you wouldn't be going up in the first place. So this slope is different, and now you are still going up at this point. Right? You still have a positive velocity. It's just getting smaller and smaller. Here's the top of your motion, because you have a velocity of zero at the very top of your motion. And then your motion, your velocity becomes negative because you're going down. Okay? And in this case, because the slope here is constant and constant, the acceleration is constant for these two segments, but it'll be different. So if you were to plot the acceleration, it would look something like this. You would have a fixed acceleration going up that's positive because you're headed up, and then your engine shuts off, and from that moment on, you're basically being pulled down by the force of Earth, which turns out the pull with an acceleration is almost 10 meters per second squared, 9.8 meters per second squared, but it's constant all the way down until you crash. Okay? And the thing I want to point out is that all of this is happening at one time, and they're all completely related. Okay? They're not independent variables, in a sense. They all depend on one another. But they all give you sort of different information. So if you want to completely describe the motion, you really have to look at all of this stuff together. But here I plot, so depending on which quantity you look at, I'm plotting meters per second, meters, or meters per second squared. But you'll note that your slope is small but increasing for your x versus t, which means you're going faster and faster, okay? And then it stops right here. You have an inflection in the slope because your engine just turned off. So your velocity no longer is increasing. It's starting to decrease. That's why the inflection here changes. You go from that kind of change in the slope to that kind of change in the slope. Right. The same thing, the second derivative, if you recall from your calculus, when you have an inflection point in a curve, you have a change in the sign of the second derivative also, that the wave that you can test for it. So this all happens at the same point because the motion is all related. And I think the only other thing I want to say is, probably. So what we have are four different kinematic variables that you need to understand when we're looking at motion for anything. There is position, and I'm generically using x for that now. We might use y, we might use z or something. MKS unit is meters. There's velocity, which is the derivative of the position. Acceleration is the derivative of the velocity. And then we have time. And so those four things are what we know as our kinematic variables. And if you want to describe motion, you basically have to tell me these four things as a function of time. And if you've gotten that, then you've actually got a description of the motion in sort of scientific detail and physics detail. Any questions? Okay, so I'll see you Thursday.